Hi, and welcome back to Apology, a podcast about books and reading. I'm Jesse Pearson, your host, and the founder of the occasionally published Apology magazine. Today's guest is the author Jonathan Lethem. He's the author of 13 novels, with perhaps Motherless Brooklyn and Fortress of Solitude being the best known, many short stories, and a wealth of nonfiction, much of which was collected in the excellent compendium, The Ecstasy of Influence. Lethem's writing is a rare cross-pollination of so-called literary fiction and so-called genre fiction. He writes ambitious, formally daring books that draw lovingly and with much knowledge on the tropes of crime, pulp, and even science fiction. As one might expect from such a writer, Lethem is widely and variously read. He can, as you'll soon learn, discuss the work of, say, Graham Greene as readily and with as much zest as, say, the work of Philip K. Dick. Lethem also teaches at Pomona College, where he is a professor of creative writing and English. I'm envious of his students who have the chance to learn from such an experienced and enthusiastic writer and reader. Lethem and I also talk in the following conversation about his latest release, Brooklyn Crime Novel, which came out late last year. It's an inventive, nostalgic, anthropological, and moving book about the borough of his upbringing, a place which has long been an obsession in his work. And while it takes place mostly in the past, the 70s and 80s, there is nothing sepia-tinted about it. Instead, Brooklyn Crime Novel feels like living history. It's a reading experience unlike any I've had in recent memory, and I'm grateful to have had the chance to speak with Jonathan for this episode. I'd also like to thank my friend and Jonathan's colleague, Lisa Ann Auerbach, for facilitating our meeting. This episode of Apology is sponsored by our friends at Sci-Fi Fantasy. Sci-Fi Fantasy fosters the exploration of free will, spirituality, and artificial intelligence in this and all other possible universes. Please visit scififantasy.co and sci.fi.fantasy on Instagram to learn more. Thank you. And now, without further preamble, Jonathan Lethem on the Apology Podcast. So what are you reading right now?
What am I reading right now? I just finished reading a book of short stories, forthcoming book of short stories by Kit Schluter, called Cartoons. And I mean, they're stories or parables or pieces. I think City Lights is bringing it out as a small book, kind of bigger than a chapbook, smaller than a book. And they're enigmatic and convulsive little surrealist jaunts. Really amazing. And Schluter is known as a translator and a poet to this point. I think this is sort of his first published fictional thing, or maybe even prose, poetry and translations up to this point. But it was amazing. Really great.
Is there a lineage of writers that you would place him in, just to get an idea?
Well, I had to come up with something, to say to help potential readers think about this enigmatic object coming into their hands. It reminded me in some ways of some of the writing Cortazar was doing later in the latter part of his career, not the earlier, more sort of filled in fictional stories and novels, but the strange little jaunts and pieces that he would specialize in and then have these compendiums of them. And I thought a little bit of Richard Brautigan too. So those were two names I dropped, but I'm sure that there are probably constellations of reference points in Schluter's reading life and his poetic practice that might even be more direct references that I'm not aware of. I mean, you know, one could also guess that he's been influenced by the French surrealists themselves. You know, it's definitely got a lineage to poetical sources, I think.
Like a Raymond Roussel or someone like that?
Like a Roussel or maybe even to the writings of some of the painters, you know, those strange things that De Chirico wrote and to things like Max Ernst's collage novels. I feel like he's really directly engaged with those sources. I don't know.
Cortazar is somebody who I've neglected.
Oh my goodness, you're really in for something great. He's an amazing writer, and he changes in the course of his writing life. You know, there are some early novels that are pretty direct. I mean, they're super dense and substantial and strange, but in a conventional fictional form. And then he writes Hopscotch, which is the thing that many people have heard of, which is this novel with a kind of fractured methodology where you can read it in different orders. There's two different contents pages. And that's an incredible experience. But really, above all, I would recommend him to you as a short story writer.
So the collected stories is the place to start.
I mean, find the stories. Yeah, Hopscotch and Other Stories is a great, great collection. But there's mountains of really good stories all through his career. And I think he's at his best. And, you know, the novels, even the ones I like best, they break down into pieces anyway. You know, I think he's good in bursts. So, marvelous short story writer.
Yeah. Yeah, I need to get into him. Is the Schluter all that you're reading, or do you tend to read more than one book at a time?
Oh, well, I usually have a bunch of stuff sort of on the table at the same time. But, you know, I'm a great enemy of the fantasy of multitasking. And never is it more absurd that the idea that you're reading more than one thing at a time. You're not. You're switching. Only machines multitask. People just switch. So I do have some other things. I got about a third of the way into Emmanuel Carrère's Yoga, his most recent book, and maybe already not my favorite of his, but I read him very compulsively. I seem to want to gobble down anything he writes. And you know, the thing that's odd for my reading life right now as well is that I'm engaged with a lot of student manuscripts, really interesting ones. I've got great, fascinating students in my workshop right now, and also in a couple of independent studies. So I think about their books a lot, which are kind of like unfinishable because I'm working with them on these in progress things. Even if they've reached a culmination of a draft, it's usually me helping them decide how to revise it. And so there's a kind of reading that you do when you're reading an interesting draft, or you're someone's interlocutor for a book, where you're sort of writing it in your brain a little bit with them. You know, you're reading it as a participant.
Yeah. Is it akin at all to the writer-editor relationship that you've experienced so many times?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I've experienced it many times, and yet I've never been really the editor of a book in the way that I'm edited. Right, I've never acquired a manuscript to publish and then guided it to publication. My experiences as an editor are more like a compiler or a DJ. I've done anthologies and also republications of things that are already clearly finished and helped kind of usher them into or annotate. I've done annotations of Philip K. Dick's stuff, but maybe yeah, it might be like that. But you know, the student instructor relationship has also got its own particulars and gravity. And so I wouldn't want to presume that it's the same kind of thing, because often all I'm doing is really getting it to a place where they can move forward with their writing life. And that might mean taking the thing that we've spent so much time on and taking it to an editor who could, or an agent or someone who could further that. But it might be that I'm doing all this in order that they reach a decision to put it aside and write the next thing. You know, that was part of my apprenticeship. And I'm working with very young writers a lot of the time, even if I'm amazed by what they're doing. They're growing and changing at such a rate that there's a thing that happens when you're working really hard as a young writer, where you get better than the book you're writing.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And then you just realize, I hope, without too much... without feeling too mournful about it, that the next thing you could write is just simply going to be better from the ground up, than, you know, that no amount of revision is going to take the thing you wrote 6 months ago and make it as good as you are a writer now. And so you just part ways. And it's, you know, that's a possibility. And at any given time when I'm working with a younger writer, that they're going to make a decision akin to the one that I made with a couple of novels and certainly with lots of short stories.
How hard is that decision to make for you?
Well, I happily don't have to make it anymore because now my rate of improvement is so measly that I can work on a book for 10 years and I'm only barely a better writer at the end than I was at the beginning. But when you're young, you're transforming so rapidly, you know?
Right.
So so you're also, you know, energetic and jubilant, and you're like you're a renewable resource. Whereas I'm like very zero sum these days. Anything good I put on the page, I better get it to print.
Is part of your process in teaching workshops recommending books to specific writers, students, based on what they are writing?
I love to do that. And I remind myself to do that all the time, not to assign books to the whole group, but to target things to people and say, hey, you know, you're thinking about something that this writer thought about. I wonder if you're familiar with them. And you might take some energy from seeing their approach to it. It's always really exciting to match people, you know, kind of prescriptively.
Yeah. Can you think of one that you've recommended recently to a specific writer?
Well, a person that I've used that way a bunch of times and did again recently is Donald Barthelme, whose sense of freedom, I think, often is really energizing for writers who are exploring something surreal or metafictional, but they're doing it as if there's a rule book that they're going to be in trouble about, or that they have to restrict it in some way that it doesn't seem necessary. And I think they might just be really glad to see this sort of boundless self-authorization that someone like Barthelme manages.
Would you say maybe 60 stories is the best entry point for Barthelme?
Sure. I mean, I usually point them to a specific story.
Okay.
It's he's so overwhelming. And then if they like him, I say, well, you're in for a good time. But I'll usually just say, you know, read The Glass Mountain, or read, you know, the Classroom, or what's the one about the two guys playing jacks in the missile silo? Yeah, it's called Game. It's just called Game.
Right. Yeah. I really remember enjoying the biography of him that came out maybe like 10 or 12 years ago.
Tracy McDaughtry.
Okay. Yeah.
He's the biographer. It's a good book. Yeah.
I noticed that you taught a seminar at Pomona called Animals in Fiction. I'd love to hear a couple of books that were on the syllabus for that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I love that. I love teaching that course, and I've taught it three different times, I think now, three times. And it's changed. I mean, I always try to not teach the exact same syllabus because it freezes for me. And if the class went especially well, that's the most dangerous of all, because then I'll try to recreate all of the epiphany moments, and the recreation never works as well as the spontaneous first time through. So there are some things that have been on the syllabus of the Animals course each time. One is Kafka. And it turns out most of my favorite Kafka could be taught in that context. The Burrow, and I always teach The Burrow, and Investigations of a Dog. The Metamorphosis fits. I don't usually use it because it's one of the only texts I can almost rely on every high school student to have encountered by the time they get to college. So I make reference to it. And then Report to an Academy, story about the ape who's been taught language by humans.
I don't know that one. That sounds
great. Great little story, and very meaningful for animal studies, I think. The ape identifies with the human world, but also pities human beings and finds them totally corrupt. But having been taught language, it has no choice but to see itself as permanently graduated out of the ape universe and into the human universe. So it goes around in this mournful kind of accepting way, smoking cigars and drinking whiskey with these horrible men.
Oh my
and,
God.
It's an incredible piece. So I teach those three Kafka stories, Investigations of a Dog, The Burrow, and Report to an Academy, every time. I've also always included some of Aesop's fables and or Aesop's Fables. I think that's the right way to say that. I've always taught Olaf Stapledon's Sirius, which is a classic British science fiction novel about a super intelligent dog. I mean, I've also always taught, even though it's not fiction, but it's literature, J.R. Ackerley's My Dog Tulip. I mean, the truth is half the course is dogs. There's dogs everywhere. I could do a course just called dogs very easily. But then I have other things that I've always done Call of the Wild, which is, you know, incredibly useful, even though a lot of them will have also read it in grade school or middle school. But connecting what they think a college literature course will be to things that they read ingenuously, like the Aesop's Fables or Call of the Wild, can be really useful too. There's a short story by Clifford Simak called Desertion, which I usually put in the course. And then I've taught Virginia Woolf's Flush, which is the novel about the Cocker Spaniel.
I haven't read that one.
Not a great Virginia Woolf novel. It's just decidedly marginal one, but it's great for the animal studies thing. I've taught Coetzee's Elizabeth Costello, and which is his novel and stories about a advocate for animal rights. I teach some portions of Darwin and Thomas Nagel's famous essay about what it would be like to be a bat.
Oh, wow. That sounds fantastic.
And I once put Faulkner's The Bear in the course. I fooled around with the syllabus and changed it a lot over the years. And then, you know, Donna Haraway has these theoretical essays about animal life that are pretty interesting. And about dogs, again, you know, dogs are often the liaison animal between the animal and the human. There's a portion of a Agamben essay called The Open that I've taught in the course. So it's a lot of philosophy, science fiction, science, and just animal stories, you know, which, you know, I think everyone relates to it without noticing that they do, because most of what you're offered to read when you're a kid has animals in it, usually has characters, you know, the wind and the willows. So I talk about that too. I don't assign them, but I talk quite a lot about Alice in Wonderland and Wind in the Willows and Watership Down. I remind them that in a way they've already been readers, students of animal fiction.
Yeah. Early on, they're indoctrinated into animals, you know, anthropomorphized and personified. Yeah. I wish I could take this class.
Well, you're making me want to teach it again.
I want to go back sort of earlier in your life. You've written about your parents as sort of bohemians, right? Your mother was very invested in the counterculture. Your father was a painter.
Yeah.
There's an essay in The Ecstasy of Influence, the books they read, right?
Yeah.
Which talks about their books a little bit, but I don't know. I was wondering if you could go a little further in telling me a book or two that you pulled down from their shelves that was eye-opening for you, that was really influential for you.
Oh my God, there's so many from those shelves. And, you know, I used to always have my parents kind of artificially segregated into, you know, my father was the painter and he's not as verbal. And I always thought he was in charge of visual culture. My mother was the big reader and she was very loquacious and heavily into conversation and advocating for reading. She would always hand me books. So I always thought, oh, all the books were my mother's. And then I would sort of open the flyleaf of these books I'd kidnapped from their shelves. And I'd be like, you know, it would say Richard Brown, Latham, Columbia University, and such a year. And I was like, wait a minute, that was one of my dad's books actually. But I mean, where do I begin? I mean, first of all, I read Dostoevsky's House of the Dead when I was like 12. God help me. That was in a little Signet paperback that I took off my mother's shelf. I read Henry Miller and Anais Nin. Anais Nin very early on. I read what else intrigued me on her shelf? There was this German Jewish novelist you rarely see his name anymore. Lion Fentwanger. Sort of these family sagas of highborn German Jews before the war. I read Norman Mailer because it was on those shelves, you know, when I was too young. And at some point, I kind of understood that I was sometimes reading things that I didn't understand yet, but I was driven by them. And I think it created an appetite for me, not just a capacity and a tolerance, but an appetite for reading while confused, for being like overwhelmed by the text and having to put full understanding to park it to one side and just be drowning and immersed in the experience and sustain anyway. I read a lot of things on those terms that I later would go back to as an adult, and I'd be like, did I really read this before? Because I turned the pages. I was, you know, Lawrence Durrell's quartet, the Alexandria Quartet.
Yeah.
But then also my mother read some classic science fiction, and she sort of steered me a little bit to those books, rightly thinking that they would be on terms that, because they weren't as psychologically or emotionally, or let alone sexually, overwhelming in their just information or in their engagement, that I would have a higher percentage of what was going on would click for me. So she kind of put my hand on the Ray Bradbury books and the Isaac Asimov books, and I devoured both those writers, and that led me into reading a lot of science fiction at the public library. There were also just things that, like, every teenager reads. I mean, happily, I can testify they still do read, like, Agatha Christie stories, which, you know, of course, more and more are also windows into a world so antiquated that it might as well be like a science fiction novel. You know, the manners and the things that people seem to think are important, or the ways that they believe it's important to behave towards one another. It's right. Like a window into some kind of alien universe. But those books still work. And my own kid, who's a reader like me, is gobbling down Agatha Christie books now.
Great. How old is your kid now, if I may ask?
This is a 13-year-old. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I've got two readers, really, but the older one is a little more consumed by factual historical stuff, memoirs and histories.
So two things that brought up for me. As a Brooklynite, when you were a kid reading Henry Miller, did any of his sort of Brooklyn work resonate with you?
Well, I mean, I did read Black Spring eventually and love the connection, but I didn't. It was almost a semi-conscious resonance. I mean, he does, you know, allude to Brooklyn here and there. He doesn't hide it, but that's not what I was principally getting out of Miller. I mean, I often think about this with both Miller and Mailer, is that they, you know, they're both Brooklyn writers in a sense, but that's not their, you know, they mostly are pointed outward. I didn't really read writers who were, you know, more directly or continuously engaged with the idea of being from where I was from until later, because mostly writers did point outward. I mean, you know, like Robert Stone was born in Brooklyn. Right. He doesn't care. He's not interested. No. But that was Brooklyn identity, was you got out. You know, it was like a home base that was like an immigrant melting pot or whatever it was, the default idea, but it was also a place to, you know, you wanted to find the world by leaving
right.
that place.
Right. I just have to pause for a moment to acknowledge the greatness of Robert Stone. Is
incredible writer.
Is Dog Soldiers your favorite of his?
The two that matter the most to me are Dog Soldiers and Flag for Sunrise. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he ever is quite at that crazy peak again. I mean, Dog Soldiers has sequences of pure writing in it that are just like electric. You know, people think of certain writers that way who are better celebrated and better remembered by younger readers now, like Dennis Johnson, for instance.
And Robert Stone was a huge influence on him, apparently.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, but there's nothing, there's no, you know, that, it, and it's that when you see someone writing in that way, that's just like electrical high wire act, where you just like, how did the sequence of sentences come to you? How did you get into that space? And it, you know, it's a privilege when you click into anything that feels even remotely like that. It's not always available, and it wasn't always available to Stone, but he's doing it a lot in Dog Soldiers. He's just in a place where you think that's supernatural.
Yeah, and what I love about it is that it has a supernatural transcendent sort of stuff, but he can also do plot. And sometimes those things don't go together.
It's true. He's those both of the two books that I love are absolutely killer thrillers too, you know? They're unbeatable on that level.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the Graham Greene side of him, right? Who's not particularly in fashion and may never be again for some reasons that we could grasp, and can be quite disappointing because he's not totally consistent even within books. But Greene was another writer I came to very young, and he's still very strongly implanted in my sense of like how a novel should work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, his structural aesthetics and his ability to make a compelling story, that kind of stuff, I think, imparts really powerfully to Robert Stone and some other people. I think he's so little read now that people might see Stone's footprint without knowing they're seeing it, you know, because he shapes so many writers after him.
Definitely. Is there a Greene? I remember being really moved by The End of the Affair.
Well, The End of the Affair is fantastic. And that's that might be, you know, for many people, I think, right, The Keeper is so vulnerable, and it's a really rare book for him being in the first person. And I treasure it. But to me, the classic Greene novel, it's a different form in many ways from the classic Greene novel, which for me is like the Heart of the Matter, The Power and the Glory. Mm-hmm. I really love one called The Comedians.
I haven't read that one. Yeah.
The Quiet American.
Yeah.
And an earlier one called Brighton Rock.
Oh, that's great. Pinky, right? Is the,
yeah.
Yeah. The protagonist.
What,
yeah.
What an amazing book that is.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned Norman Mailer, and I was going to ask you about him because he's one of those writers. Do you know how sometimes writers will have a persona that precedes them? I mean, obviously,
yeah.
Right?
Well, and Mailer is the supreme example of that.
Right. And I think also of like Bukowski or,
yeah.
Or Hunter S. Thompson. Yeah. And that often makes me avoid that person as a writer.
Yeah, well, people are avoiding Mailer's persona in droves these days. It's going to probably keep him from being read very, very much anymore. He seems just an impossible person to want to spend any time around.
Have you seen that video on YouTube of Rip Torn beating him up?
I know that footage from, it was, I mean, he included portions of the fight in the movie to his credit in a way, in the movie he directed, he puts the attack.
Oh, good. Okay.
Into the movie. Yeah.
Anyway, that was just a little aside. What should I read by Mailer first?
So you've never given him a go of any kind?
I haven't at all.
I mean, see, the trick to Mailer is it's not really like, despite the persona that he's interesting, it's that he writes inside and through that persona. And so for better or worse, I think, you know, I think I even put this in print somewhere. The only great character that Norman Mailer ever invented was Norman Mailer. And I would read The Armies of the Night or Advertisements for Myself, which are both persona books, but they're very self-aware. And he's putting himself in the foreground as a buffoon and as an intellectual and as a error-prone man of action, someone who wants things to happen and then screws up a lot. And they're thrilling on those terms. If you can accept that, you know, you're kind of reading a nonfiction fiction about a character named Norman Mailer.
stepping back again a little bit, what's a book that disturbed you as a child?
Well, what? That's a great question. What did disturb me as a child? It's funny because, of course, I named some super sexualized things, but I think some combination of the sense of play and freedom in, you know, because I read like, you know, Nin and Miller, mm-hmm. and also Erica Jong and a bunch of other stuff like that before I'd ever had sex. But I just think it got me thinking it was going to be a gas because they're all pretty delighted to be in that part of themselves. Those weren't disturbing books at all. And the Dostoevsky I mentioned, which I certainly remember the horrors associated with it, was galvanizing. But I was also, I really believed that the world had dark secrets, and I was really grateful to the writers who showed me what they knew. Mm-hmm. I always felt paradoxically consoled by the bad news when it was delivered at that level that Dostoevsky does in House of the Dead, or you know, in a different sense that Kafka did when I encountered him. I felt consoled by Kafka. I was like, oh yeah, okay. I'm not alone in these apprehensions about sort of what's wrong with being and reality. Yeah. So I would say, what disturbed me sincerely? I think that the things that disturbed me most were the writers who I was really drawn to. I mean, this is funny because this almost points back to Green and Stone, although I don't feel that so much about them. But reading Orwell's Burmese Days and reading Somerset Maugham's short stories, when I got like a back door into the conundrums of, you know, I think this was, in a way, it was present for me in E.M. Forster too, with Passage to India. The British Empire, I wanted so powerfully to identify with those books and those writers and those aesthetics that I found myself in spaces that were making me feel the pressure of colonialism and white privilege in a way where I had no language for it. And, you know, it's like, in so many instances, it's like half critiqued and half undigested, you know, in those places. And I really devoured writing like that. And I was interested in finding writing that reminded me of it. So then I like found myself reading, you know, Naipaul and Paul Theroux. And it was like a form of bother that I couldn't name, but it wasn't as simple for me as reading like Dostoevsky or Kafka or Philip K. Dick or Raymond Chandler, because it was about a thing that it wasn't letting itself understand completely. Mm-hmm. You know, the racial other was so constantly, you know, there and incompletely acknowledged at the same time. You know, it's like watching a lot of Westerns or something.
Yeah, definitely.
Which I was also driven to do a bit later. And it's like, you're like, oh my God, they're like right on the edge of the subject that's so urgent. They're like almost telling you that they know what's wrong with American history. And then they're also completely failing.
Yeah.
And that it's tormenting to be brought to the brink of a grasp or a language, you know, a vocabulary, a narrative, literary vocabulary for a subject that burns to be engaged with, and then have it always, you know, brushed off or danced around or done wrong.
Are there books that you can think of since, in the many decades since Maugham and Orwell, that have done the job that you're talking about?
Well, sure. I mean, lots of people have taken it from various sides, and I'm thinking of the British tradition, which for some reason I was a real Anglophile at a certain point. You know, I and it's not just people I've named, but also, you know, I was reading a lot of other famous UK novelists, Iris Murdoch and Muriel Spark. I just, you know, I was like, there's something about the form that their commitment to novelistic form meant a lot to me. But, and so when you ask that question, I then think of course, the Ben Okri and Salman Rushdie and, you know, the generation that came and specifically grabbed hold of the same aesthetic tradition, you know, and that goes right up to, you know, Zadie Smith's White Teeth.
Right, right. What's a book that disturbed you as an adult?
There's a good question too. What's a book that disturbed me as an adult? Well, you know, I just read one. Good Disturbance. Lynn Tillman's Mother Love.
Oh, I love her, but I haven't read this one yet.
It's a killer. As someone dealing, as so many of us are, with matters of elder care, she is so unflinching. And it's an abyss that she opens up, the contemplation of the parent on that, on those terms. Something I have not dreamed I would or could ever do in my own. I couldn't imagine making my own terms for what she did. But so that was healthily, vividly and intentionally disturbing book to read. But you're asking me these questions is making me realize that I don't feel badly disturbed too often. I mostly want to be, you know, like I said, I had developed a capacity for sustaining confusion. I think I also sustain disturbance, and I usually think I'm where I need to be if I'm disturbed. So I'm not reluctant to be.
That idea, going back for a moment, of sustaining confusion was really interesting to me, reading books maybe when you're not quite ready for them as a kid, because that's the way that I've talked with another guest, I forget who, about reading poetry. That's sort of my method for reading poetry, is just letting it be, I don't know if this is a word, but osmotic or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Do you read poetry?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, mostly the poetry that I really return to, I don't understand it entirely. John Ashbery, being, you know, I mean, I understand it maybe as much as he wants me to. But this reminds me of a thing that it's become one of my little pet axioms in the creative writing classroom, that I believe in revision to such an extent that I believe you can revise things you don't understand and make them better anyway. You know, and you know, I think about that also in terms of collaboration, that you can engage with another person's language and syntax and imagery and thinking at levels that don't inspire, you know, that precede full confident, you know, like you wouldn't want to try to paraphrase it or explain it to someone else, but you could still work on it. Obviously, you can read it and be with it, but, you know, like when I have written songs with certain songwriters, sometimes I can advance the cause and change the language that they've written without grasping everything that they intended.
Yeah.
Or even mean.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can still make the language better and sharper and more specific and you know, be involved in it.
Yeah. That's really interesting, because I think people, maybe me as well, often think of revision as a form of clarifying.
Right. You know? Well, it can, I guess there are different ideas about what clarity could be. I mean, you know, John Ashbery's poems are radically full of clarity in every individual gesture.
Right.
There's no absence of clarity.
but in the totality of them.
And then in other senses that you might intend that word, they refuse it.
Let's talk about Brooklyn Crime Novel.
Yeah.
I was trying to, as I read it, think of precedents for it, because like I was saying before we started recording, the structure is so fascinating to me. I feel like you're going to see a lot of reviews that use the word kaleidoscopic, maybe,
yeah.
Which is fine.
I'll take it.
No, it's great. I mean, it's vignetted, I guess you could say, too. But also, it's not just the structure, but also the obsession with a place. The only things that I thought of were like Patterson by William Carlos Williams.
Oh, that's great.
And
I love that book, and I will love that. I will love it if that comparison comes up. That's maybe I'll be so bold as to offer it up myself now that you reminded me of it. That's a good one. There's the awkwardest for me is one that's come up a couple of times, and I thought of it before anyone suggested it. But there's the John Dos Passos trilogy,
the USA trilogy,
and yeah, the only trouble being, I've only read the first volume of that, and it didn't drive me to read the next two. I mean, I it's great that it exists. It's one of those books where I see its importance and distinctiveness, but it wasn't like really my cup of tea. But you know, it might be nevertheless a little bit of a reference point.
Mm-hmm.
In groping for one for the way I refract. And even engage with documents and evidence, you know, the way he does. But, you know, I was thinking at certain points when I was writing it that what I was really doing was what in cinema is called the essay film.
Like a Chris Marker or Adam Curtis?
Absolutely. Chris Marker or maybe a little, I love Adam Curtis, but maybe a little more Chris Marker than Adam Curtis.
Yeah.
Because of the more fractured, but also more intimate quality. Adam Curtis is like a distant, you know, god on Jupiter,
right?
Beaming thoughts down for us to have, but he doesn't kind of come into the space and cajole us personally the way Chris Marker does. And Orson Welles has, you know, that example with F for Fake, and which might be kind of like the essay film. And it's very vocal, I think. It's very much about the presence of the implicit author, you know, the me that's not quite me, but that is kind of worrying and laughing and provoking all the way through the book, I think, is really the plot of the book is its voice. And that's what makes all of the different pieces into one thing. And so that seems to me kind of like an essayistic structure.
I think that's a really interesting comparison, Chris Marker. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The only other thing that I thought of, and it made me go back and read this again, was Winesburg, Ohio by Sherwood Anderson.
Oh, yeah. I haven't read that in a long time. I never would have thought of that, but maybe I should have a look at it.
It holds up. But there's a we, right? Maybe it's a royal we, I'm not sure, to Brooklyn Crime Novel. Do you know who that we is? Did you have a conception of that character?
Yeah, well, the game in the book, in some ways, which I don't mind semi spoiling, is that there's a terrible, urgent desire for a collective consciousness, because I think the book feels, the voice of the book feels that something, a collective existed at one time, and it's trying to resurrect it on the page. And then at some point that wish breaks down in the face of the evidence, and the we turns into an individual confession. That's one of the, I think, you know, it sounds pretty esoteric, but I think that's one of the actually dramatic arcs of the book, is the plot of the we that turns into just one voice who was trying to garb itself, cloak itself in collectivity. Because of the wish for collectivity. So it's also about the tension in my own experience between what I recall of the past and what I can believe other people will identify with or be persuaded by.
There's a lot in the book about crossing and not crossing race and lines of race and class.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, and boy girl.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, I mean, race and class are symptoms of those, you know, they're partly symptoms of gentrification, I suppose. Or I guess that's totally true, actually. But the boy-girl stuff is interesting. Is that more about, I mean, I'd say, I don't know if it's a bulk of the book, but much of the book is about teens and preteens, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because it's a book written by an older writer. You know, I wrote about childhood in Brooklyn, right? Once before with The Fortress of Solitude when I was in my 30s. But in that book, I was super identified with the adults in many ways. I mean, the book centers these two boys, but their parents are powerfully present characters. And then they grow up and there's a lot of like, this is what it's like to be a grown-up who was one of those kids. In this book, I think here I am in my late 50s, and I actually kind of gave the book to the kids. I wanted to keep remembering that whatever else all these criminals, all these perpetrators and victims were, and often the majority of the characters are both perpetrators and victims. I think that's one of the things the book is adamant about. They were fundamentally children, bewildered and thrust into this space without any, you know, not of their own volition. And so that sensation of constantly reasserting, these are children we're reading about, was really, it was almost like the compass for the novel.
There's also this sort of, you know, there's a lot of evidence presented in the book, right?
Yeah.
Or documentary sort of stuff. And it made me think of like, I don't know, the phrase that came to my mind was forensic nostalgia, because
great.
It's kind of like—
That's great, amazing.
And you sometimes you put it in the voice of a character, like the Wheeze, for example, the character the Wheeze like tells the history of the native peoples of Brooklyn, for example. How important is nostalgia to you?
Well, I don't, under that term, nostalgia, I mostly tried to thwart it or expose it. I think nostalgia typically for me raises the specter of a kind of sentimentalized, wishful recollection. Yeah, this was the golden light that I was trying not to shine on these occurrences. So I wanted to defeat the risk of nostalgia with this constant self-interrogation and doubt that casts everything in, as you say, more forensic terms, where it's an inquiry into the past and simultaneously an attempt. You know, nostalgia, the other thing about nostalgia is it situates by implication in the present. It's the glance back. I actually didn't want to be here glancing back. I wanted to resurrect the past like a forensic reconstruction and then enter into it and wander around and look at it like, okay, here it is again. What is it? What was it really? You know?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. There are also elements of autobiography embedded in it. Maybe only if you've read, like, you know, well, like The Ecstasy of Influence is a book that I really, really like a lot.
And I
remember a lot of it. And I was like, wait, there's that Henry, that's it, Henry Miller, Michael Frankel, Hamlet from that one essay. Or there's that, that horde of Lovecraft books in the, maybe in the basement of a bookstore. Did you know, as you set out to write Brooklyn Crime Novel, that the autobiography elements would be a part of it?
I didn't concern myself with how much or how little I would lend to these characters to make them feel alive to me. I knew I was going to distribute little scraps of myself into innumerable places in the book. That how could I not do that? And I didn't reread older treatments. I didn't reread Fortress of Solitude, and I didn't reread The Disappointment Artist or The Ecstasy of Influence. The places where I come out of hiding the most are in those two essay collections and in The Fortress of Solitude. But I didn't feel that I would have to. I mean, I'm embedded in myself. That's the given. The trick in this book was to fling my voice, to use as violent a ventriloquism of others as I could, and just be shattered and distributed. You know, every character gains maybe a little something from touching a part of my life, but I don't think I'm locatable in any one of them in any way that matters to the way the book is organized. And you spoke of there being obvious evidence or even documentation in the book, but there's another hidden layer, which is the oral historical element that fuels it. I did a lot of conversation with kids from the hood. You know, I was really researching this book, not just on the level of microfiche and old newspaper clippings, which some of which made their way directly into the book, but in a way that you wouldn't know unless I just testify, as I'm doing now. I let other people's voices come into this book. I mean, to an extent that is utterly unlike anything I've written before. I had 4, 5, 6 hour conversations with people I hadn't seen since we were both teenagers, and just let their thinking colonize big pieces of this story. You know, there are chapters that belong to individuals, not because it's a portrait of them, because there are no portraits one-to-one.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not a secret, you know, nonfiction book in that sense. Like, here's a bunch of people I knew and I've just thinly disguised them. But in the sense that their voicing of the past seemed so important once I'd heard it that I wanted it to just take over some mm-hmm. portion of the story.
Yeah. Oral history as part of the DNA totally makes sense now that I think about it. That's really, really, what an interesting way to work.
Well, it was lucky for me. I mean, I've been blessed with the eloquence and the dedication of some of my witnesses, my friends and acquaintances, and the people I was able to reacquaint myself with after long, long distance and silence. Weirdly, the book benefited from being written partly during the quarantine time, because people my age, I think especially, maybe you'll identify with us, we were thrust so deep into ourselves during that isolation. There was a lot of memory work that people were doing semi-voluntarily.
Mm-hmm.
Who am I? When you moved into that sensory deprivation chamber of the early quarantine, people were making these radical voyages into their past and their sense of self and their sense of origin. And I was lucky enough to tap into some of that in these conversations. I think people had nothing, you know, in a more literal sense, people had nothing else to do but talk and remember, because the world was providing so little reflection of their present selves. They started to rely on recollection to understand what it was to be a person. So I would get into these talks with people who weren't necessarily writers or even very focused, not fixated the way I am on having come from Brooklyn in the 70s, right? But mm-hmm. at this moment in early quarantine, they were susceptible to my power of suggestion. I'd say, well, let's ask some key questions about this part of your life. And they might initially say, I don't think about it that often. And then 5 hours later, it was like I turned a faucet on.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just awash in everything they were coming, that the conversation, the interaction between us was bringing forth. Because I wouldn't just say, tell me some stuff. I'd have questions. I wanted to know what some of these occurrences that I remembered looked like from their side. And I wanted to know sometimes whether they'd really happened at all or whether I'd made them up.
Right.
And that question brings up a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, one question it brings up is, what kind of a narrative do we want to tell about our own pasts based on things that we're sort of confabulating or making up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's true that you have a Philip K. Dick tattoo.
Yes.
It's the Ubik spray can
of Ubik with a pink spray pointed towards me, because of course one wants to be the recipient of the Ubik, which reverses entropy.
Okay, yeah. For those who don't know, can you sort of like, what's the 101 on Ubik?
It's a spray product from his novel Ubik. It's titled after the product, and this is an ointment or a spray product that when you get hold of it, if you can get hold of some, it's sometimes in scarce supply, reverses entropy. So very handy thing to have around when things are, you know, in decline, as they always tend to
be. Right. Which is the best book for someone who's totally new to Dick to begin with? And which is Dick's most challenging book?
Oh, God, great question.
And is it a rewarding read, even though it's difficult? Yeah.
You know, he's got so many different novels, and I know which ones are better left aside. It's easy to say which ones not to start with. When I'm talking to someone who's curious about trying to read Philip K. Dick and hasn't done, I'll usually try to suss what kind of reader they are. If they are unfamiliar with science fiction, or all they have associated with it is like stuff they're kind of, you know, guilty pleasures, like watching Star Trek or something, but they're a literary reader, I will usually point them to one of the books that functions more like a literary novel, and where his language is a little more pressured and typical of what the reader of the quote unquote mainstream novel would expect. So then I'll say, take a look at A Scanner Darkly, or take a look at The Man in the High Castle, or sometimes I'll even say, you know, this is a strange place to go, but his last novel, The Transmigration of Timothy Archer, which is a masterpiece, his last published novel, I should say, I think he was working on, there's at least portions of a book after that. And it basically is a traditional literary novel, but with his obsessions and his voice inside it. So it can be a really good gateway drug for someone who's very science fiction resistant. But if someone is like, oh, I don't know, what would they say? Ursula Le Guin. I love Sam and Delaney. You can't freak me out. Uh-huh. I'll say, well, you should, you know, read one of the absolutely over the top, crazy, beautiful science fiction novels. Read Martian Timeslip or The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch. Mm-hmm. That one, often, if someone's up for the wild stuff, you know, if it's someone who likes William S. Burroughs, if it's a kind of counterculture person who's digs, you know, who's become interested in Philip K. Dick because they've heard he's kind of druggy and fun and all over the place, I'll say read Ubik Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, or even one of the, you know, later kind of more surreal ones like Maze of Death, Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said, which are novels that don't make conventional sense, but they're really great trips.
Yeah, very trippy. Another sort of give us the introductory spiel question would be Stanislav Lem, who I haven't really done much of, and I'd really like to.
Well, he's a very different writer from Philip K. Dick in the sense that he's consummately in control of what he's doing, but he's confusing to look at from the outside because there are kind of multiple renditions of what he thought was important to do. And one of the things that people encounter, of course, one of the first things people will tend to encounter is Solaris because of the film. And it is one of his greatest novels, although the translation problem with that book is significant. The prose in the version of Solaris that circulates most frequently in English is pretty choppy because it was a double translation. Somebody translated it from Russian into French, and then someone translated the French into English.
Oh my God.
And so it's not the most sublime reading experience, but it's a very pure accomplishment for him. One of his great novels, for sure. He can be a very challenging, kind of philosophical and dense writer. In that mode, his greatest masterpiece, I think, is a book called His Master's Voice. But that is it's so philosophical that the fiction sometimes falls away. On the other hand, as a surrealist, he's got these books that are extraordinary, like Memoirs Found in a Bathtub. That's a book I'm very devoted to. He can write books that are almost like Don DeLillo, kind of these sleek, alienated thrillers, The Investigation and Chain of Chance. His last really serious science fiction novel, which is called Fiasco, is another masterpiece, but it's probably not a starting point because it's very dense and intricate, and it takes a while to get off its launch pad. So if you love Solaris and his master's voice, Fiasco is a great experience to have. He also has a lot of short stories about kind of kooky space travelers and kooky robots. And often people encounter those first and they think, oh, this guy's sort of like a not that funny humorist, because it's fairly deliberate, his sense of humor. They're sort of whimsical, allegorical tales about futuristic things. And I think in some ways that's the version of his work that's, for me anyway, aging the most, or I don't know. They're just people who do things like that much. I like Italo Calvino's Cosmic Comics. So enchanted, so light on its feet, so immortal. Those stories will be read forever. I feel like Calvino's kind of doing what Lem's trying to do, but 100 times better. So I would leave the humorous Lem to one side.
Okay.
I mean, there's humor incorporated into the more serious and dark novels. But when he's doing his whimsical tales, I don't think, unless you become obsessed with Lem, I don't think those are the place to begin reading him.
Where was he living for most of his life? Was he in the city or the country?
Well, he was on the other side of the Iron Curtain. He's an urban guy, very much. But when he was able to move to Western Europe, he lived in Vienna.
Okay. I asked because I was wondering, and maybe you know, maybe you don't, if there was an equivalent behind the Iron Curtain of the sort of sci-fi magazines that so many people publish stories in.
Yeah, no, he more or less worked in a vacuum. As the great, Iron Curtain science fiction writer, but he wasn't Russian, he was Polish. He had a rival in the form of these Russian science fiction writers, the brothers Strugatsky, who are very much worth reading as well.
Roadside Attraction.
Yeah. And The Ugly Swans and many other remarkable books. Definitely Maybe.
I don't know that one.
They're wonderful, but I think Lem didn't care for them, or he was too rivalrous to enjoy their collegiality. And anyway, they were Russians and he was Polish. It wasn't like Heinlein and Asimov getting to hang out or something.
Yeah.
And otherwise his field of reference was the very small trickle of translated English language science fiction that was coming his way. And that was initially mostly very early examples. And he was reading Stapledon and Wells, and he extrapolated for himself a genre that was all as kind of serious and accomplished as Stapledon and Wells. And when he finally got a chance to read the preponderance of 20th century American pulp science fiction, he was massively disappointed and felt betrayed, because he was imagining that there was this, in a way, field of companions for him who were doing serious extrapolation. And he found most of their work to be so trite that it was beneath his dignity. And yet he found one example that he regarded as the saving grace, and that was Philip K. Dick, who he thought was just as unsystematic as the other pulp science fiction that he was being, finally able to read because it translated into Polish, but redeemed by its visionary, surrealistic brilliance, which I think is accurate.
Yeah.
Dick wasn't a systematic writer the way Lem was.
Mm-hmm.
He worked by intuition.
Yeah. I think this could serve as a final question. And I hope it isn't too much of a hoary old chestnut for you, but having been so involved in the sci-fi and the so-called literary worlds, there's this divide between the two, and I wonder if you have any ideas as to why you think it was initially structured like that.
Well, I mean, everybody...
I should say the genre world and the literary world.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody's so fascinated by the impulse behind these taxonomies, but I think it's really important to talk about it as historically material, you know, it kind of like a Marxist materialist sense, historically conditioned. It's specific to all kinds of things, and that we're going to now make a very quick set of indications and know that this could be a conversation you could have for hours. The extraordinary expansion in literacy created a number of demimonds of what you might call paraliterary activity, forms of writing, magazine writing. I mean, remember, the novel was initially regarded as a subliterary form. Literature was poetry and the essay. Novels were like pulp.
Soap operas.
Soap operas. They were for bored housewives, effectively. And then they get retrieved for the idea of the literary. They get, you know, very late in the day, they get moved up into a space where they could be equivalents to the poetical or essayistic modes. But that's not the origin place of the novel. Well, you know, and of course you have magazine and newspaper writing, and you have serial novels, and you have all kinds of paraliterary activities, right? Writing that isn't exalted. The phenomenon of these, what these genres that existed initially, mostly in literally pulp magazine form, detective stories and westerns and, you know, popular science fiction, disposable science fiction, these kind of reading demimonds that grew out of this, which contained, of course, you know, you don't want to make any one sweeping judgment about or assessment of what was contained in them, because it was all kinds of things. It was people who were trying to become Orson Welles. I mean, excuse me, H.G. Wells or Stapledon, and falling short, or sometimes not falling short. You know, Arthur C. Clarke gets there a couple of times, right? It contains cynical, you know, penny a word storytellers who are just slamming out as many gripping tales as they can think of, you know, to stay alive. And they were often writing in multiple genres at the same time. You know, they'd write a horror story for a horror pulp, and they'd write a science fiction story and a Western story in the evening, you know. And it contains then the fans of these things who start to want to write them and are dedicated to and immersed in these milieus of, or these languages, these lexicons that are forming in a way that's uncanny, because they are identified with a thing that someone might have written in a half-assed way, but to them it's like gospel. So you have these people who self-invent. You know, I mean, you see this in a lot of realms. The first rock and roll records are made by slumming bluesmen or jazz musicians as jokes.
Novelty records.
Yeah, and then you get a kid who grows up listening to them is like, that's the gospel. I mean, comic book heroes... The comic books were not written by people who loved superheroes, because the superheroes didn't exist and they thought they were making up a kind of silly thing for children. And then you get readers who take them so seriously, and that's the next generation who writes those stories, or the people who believe in them. Mm-hmm. So anyway, but it also ingrains all kinds of sociological and political reality, class distinction. You have to read Pierre Bourdieu, right? The invention of taste as a way for the bourgeoisie and the aristocracy to delineate themselves. Mm-hmm. So there has to be an outside. There has to be a beneath. Mm-hmm. There has to be something that's beyond the pale. So science fiction, for a number of decades, from which it has never recovered its self-image, became a very specifically official kind of beyond the pale paraliterature that could never achieve legitimacy. And this is social ritual as much as it's any kind of meaningful, it's not literary criticism. Mm-hmm. It's something other than that. It's the making of class and social distinction that hardens some of these boundaries. And then, of course, you get the fascinations that occur when a subculture finds itself sort of containerized and decides to harden that container from the inside as well.
Right. Right.
Can't fire me, I quit, right? So then you get a whole para pantheon or canon where people are like, oh, the most important writer in the 1950s is Robert Sheckley. You know, and someone outside that canon is like, who, what are you talking about? And they're like, go away, we're not interested in your opinion. Right? So you get this like alternate hierarchy of value.
Yeah.
Alternate system of values. And those, that generates a weirdness and a beauty and a whole body of criticism and whole realm of activity that's like literature, but in a pocket universe.
It's like to continue your sort of like economics analogy, it's like a closed market, like a circular closed market.
Sure. Right. Absolutely. Of value and taste. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's really,
and, then to make the full, you know, to make sure we endorse what our intuitions tell us is true. It just so happens that particular, you know, field of disreputable alternate values was inventing a language for talking about the overwhelming impact of technological development upon human experience, which the culture needed desperately. The language, the iconography, the set of tools and discernments that science fiction excavated on its own time was so, the culture was so desperately in need of it that then when the dam breaks, everyone adopts it, which is why basically everyone writes science fiction now.
Thanks to Jonathan for his time and generosity in this conversation. It was a pleasure hosting him and hearing his thoughts and recommendations. You can find more Apology in various ethereal locations, such as Apology_zine on Instagram, Apology Reviews on Substack, and at patreon.com/apology. This podcast is completely independent, and your support there would be greeted with undying gratitude. This episode was recorded by me from my home in Mount Washington, Los Angeles. It was edited by Justin Geller in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and facilitated by Lars Kreslins, also of Philadelphia. The music is Bach, arranged and performed by Cyrus Germani, whom I believe still resides in Los Angeles. Thanks very much. Talk to you again soon.